Hello, and welcome again to another conservative historian podcast. This one entitled The Spider King and Successful Foreign Policy. The date is April 2024, and my name is A.D. Tippett. Before I get into the podcast, I would just ask you to check out all of our podcasts. We have over 200 of them, an article in the Freeman newsletter, and additional articles coming up. I will mention what those are in the future, but please check out all of that content, and you will like the price. It is free, not behind any paywalls. And now, the Spider King. It is not often that nations learn from the past, even rarer that they draw the correct conclusions from it. Henry Kissinger. But for great evils, drastic remedies are necessary, and whoever has to treat them should not be afraid to use the instrument which cuts the best. Clemens von Metternich. Now, I have to confess an affinity for stories of those who get by on their brains rather than by raw physicality or good looks. Watching Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt outthink his opponent in the Mission Impossible movies has always been more fun than watching him outfight them. Who does not secretly admire fictional anti-heroes like Michael Corleone or Tom Ripley using their cleverness to escape from various traps? I mean, we're not supposed to really like these guys, but don't secretly we kind of find ourselves rooting for them? Partly is this just to see how are they going to get out of this one? How are they going to outthink their opponents? And the same goes for historical figures. Caesar may have conquered far and wide, but it was his cunning great nephew that forged a lasting empire and died of old age. Liu Bang, the first emperor of the Chinese Han Dynasty in 2002 BCE, was among the few dynastic originators to have been born into a peasant family. Was he an amazing soldier who conquered far and wide? Well, he was successful militarily, but it was his brains that established one of the golden ages of ancient China. Another is Elizabeth I of England. Somehow she skirted death through her sister Mary, walked the razor's edge of Catholic versus Protestant religion, and stopped an invasion by the most powerful nation in Europe. The industrial build-out of America in the late 19th century, remember, valued listener, I hate the term Gilded Age, also accompanied a raft of people who made much money from the build-out without perhaps creating a whole lot. Andrew Carnegie, due to his labor practices in the Johnstown flood, may not be hailed as he once was, but he did build the steel industry in America to the point where 70 years later, America could outproduce the Japanese Empire and the German Reich combined in critical steel manufacturing. Now, his contemporary Jay Gould, he did not get such glowing press, but again, this guy was always mentally a step ahead of his opponents. Not some downtrodden laborer, but I'm talking about the likes of Cornelius Vanderbilt and James J. Hill. I have always liked that where Gould was ruthless and unscrupulous in business, he lived a quiet personal life of devotion to his wife and children. I've always really liked that dichotomy. Absolutely ruthless in the boardroom. His daughter later, when a lot of these people were describing Gould as this sort of almost evil figure, said, "I didn't recognize the man they were talking about." So when I see an awful movie such as Napoleon compared with something impressive like Oppenheimer, I imagine all sorts of historical epics in the same vein that, well, unfortunately only exist in my mind, alas. For example, I'd love to see a big-budget story on Horatio Nelson, or how about a faithful 8-episode biopic of Grover Cleveland? There was a lot going on in his life. Or a film about Leonardo da Vinci. And for those who love movies or shows with a genius, plotting anti-hero, the real-life Louis XI, King of France, would make a great series. Suppose you like the machinations of Tyrion Lannister from Game of Thrones, the cold calculation of Tony Soprano, or the sinister schemes of the Underwoods in House of Cards. You don't need these fictions, because we have the real thing. And like Gandalf of Lord of the Rings, Louis had many names. Some called him Louis the Prudent. Others called him the Devil. And even others, including biographer Paul Murray Kendall, called him the Spider. Long before George R. R. Martin applied all his animal names, probably too many animal names in my opinion in his books, including the unique varies, Lewis had the name as the Spider King and earned it. In the book about one of Lewis's successors, Francis I by Francis Hackett, the writer flowerily notes of Lewis, inside Francis' methods were single-minded. He outwitted his feudal lords. Outside he showed the deep peasant acumen of his people. He looked at his neighbors with one in his head, the power to him to do evil. This belief in their power and intentions was the mainspring of Lewis's craftiness. Lewis had the brains with which to outwit his dynastic rivals while avoiding the wet footprints of melodrama. I love that writing. Now, some writing, such as Hackett's, who composed Francis I back in the 1930s, that's when he wrote his book, seems a bit too ornate for hard-headed history. But what are historians if not writers as well? On the medievalist.net blog, there's a piece by Susan Abernathy, and she writes, King Louis XI's administration and consolidation of his kingdom and his flair for diplomacy earned him the sobriquet of the Prudent, but his favorite pastimes are plotting and conspiracy. He even earned the names Cunning and Universal Spider due to the webs of intrigue he would spin around Europe. It seems he was never happier than when he was planning his next scheme. I'm creating quite a character here. One of the reasons, though, that Paul Murray Kendall called him the Spider was is Lewis also, in addition to his web of intrigues, also created and built roads, including roads that would crisscross the entirety of France, all the way from Picardy in the north to Guienne in the south, all of these locations throughout his kingdom. So that, too, was his web of roads, if you will. The Spider wasn't just the concept of planning intrigue, though obviously that's probably the primary reason they call him that. Yet too much focus, though too on that plotting, misses the best point about Lewis. And this is one of the sort of the takeaways from his life. His schemes had a purpose. He knew what he wanted to accomplish, and all his efforts were aimed at that goal. Louis was born in 1423 when the English controlled much of northern France, and what they did not reign over was in the hands of many French nobles, and especially the Burgundians. At different points in history, the Burgundians, even though they were technically vassals of the French king, actually had more wealth, more power, and as much land directly ruling as their supposed liege lords. During his childhood and early adult years, Louis's father, Charles VII, and the French managed to wrest much of the land back from the English. However, at Louis's accession, several feudal lords, including those controlling Burgundy, first Philip of Burgundy and then later his son Charles the Bold, challenged Louis for supremacy. And Charles the Bold, again, all these guys seem to have these nicknames, was one of the most powerful and belligerent princes of the 15th century and would become Louis's most obdurate enemy. Louis's goal was to create a France where the crown was paramount, not a first among equals, but instead the ruler, unquestioned ruler, over all his nobles as much as the French peasants. That was his goal. That was his focus. As Abernathy noted, by the 1470s, with the death of Charles the Bold, Louis was master of France. The three estates of the commons, the churchmen, and the nobles were all subject to the crown. Louis had broken the power of feudalism. Industry flourished throughout the kingdom, and the crown collected sufficient taxes on a regular basis. That's the other thing that gets lost. A lot of historians will focus in on Louis's crushing of the feudal system, and I'll talk in a little bit later about how he kind of is supposed to represent this bridge between the medieval and the modern. But Louis was also a smart king in terms of economics and in terms of spend, as we shall see. Now, many historians place Louis as the French king who stood astride the bridge between the middle and the modern ages. He founded feudal France and left it a nation state, or so that's the story. This is an oversimplification. As late as the 1600s, Louis XIV built Versailles as an expediency to further curb the power of his nobles. And Louis was not exactly alone as a monarch contending with his barons. English and German history is rife with overmighty earls, counts, and dukes who disputed the power of the monarch in their lands and affairs. And in fact, a direct correlation of Louis' time was the War of the Roses, in which Henry VI of England was being overthrown by some of his feudal lords. In Louis' case, his grandfather's madness left France vulnerable to English predations and Burgundian pretensions. No, his father, with the help of a French maid, yes, it's Joan of Arc, who heard voices, was the one who helped oust England from most of France. So Charles, even though Charles VII, Louis' father, was king, he was still kind of seen as the first among equals. And they, the feudal lords, were not giving up their rediscovered privileges. Louis aimed to break them and accrue power back to where he felt it was best used, by the crown. And of course, meaning himself. Now, here's what's interesting about Louis. In that era, the English tended to win battles due to their superior tactics, especially the longbow. The Swiss would later win conflicts due to their pikemen. The Burgundians, those ones under Philip and Charles, were considered to have the best weapon, the cannon, which was barely 60 years old. Burgundian artillery was legendary throughout Europe. Now, Louis' French royal forces had no such technical advantage. Given the numbers arrayed against him, Louis could not bring overwhelming military numbers, and he was not a brilliant field commander. Both Charles the Bold and Edward IV of England were better in the field of battle. The Burgundian state of the late 15th century controlled the Low Countries, whose wools and linens created incredible wealth, so Louis could not even beat them through sheer spending. Instead, his best and only opportunity was to outthink his many enemies, and part of this was clarity about his goals. For example, when Edward IV invaded France in league with Burgundy, Louis kept the latter occupied in Germany and the former suspicious of its ally. Though Louis was undoubtedly a typical medieval ruler in his great passion for hunting, he was unique in his desire to manage his expenses well. He didn't keep a magnificent court, but stayed on the road with a small retinue, constantly riding on horseback. He dressed plainly, usually in hunting garb, so he could leave the road and hunt when the fancy struck him. He would sup with peasants and avoid official welcomes in towns by turning off the main road on arrival, adds Abernathy. Meanwhile, the Burgundian court dazzled visitors with its pomp and ceremony, especially in the case of Charles, who kept a large army and was not averse to using it. Louis made the simple calculation that spending money on bribes or buying time was more cost-effective than the ruinous expenses and management headaches of raising armies. Not that military force was not utilized by Louis. He participated in several battles and sieges. Instead, he was different from those of his time who believe war was the first, not the last resort. The last resort for war, for Louis, was always the way to go. As Hackett adds, he did not rely on war, he relied on money, and he bribed left and right. But when you say that Hackett says that he relied on money, one of the calculations Louis noted was that the ability to bribe people was less than the cost of raising an army. And bribing was very effective because, remember, while Louis was counting his money and keeping track of it, his feudal lords were spending it, especially Charles. And Charles, with all the wealth produced by the Low Countries, actually had to resort to borrowing. The wealthiest prince in the West had to rely on Italian bankers, something Louis did not need to do. If there is a godfather to the tiny canon of Louis XI, at least for English readers, that would be Paul Murray Kendall, who wrote his book The Universal Spider in 1971. This is where Abernathy got the title. One of the things illuminated in Kendall's book is the all-encompassing strategic nature of Louis' foreign policy. Knowing he could not outspend people like Duke Charles, he figured out ways to reduce the Burgundian revenue. Whether limiting food supplies to the Low Countries, setting up alternative commerce centers, or never granting trading concessions. As Kendall says, otherwise, in measure after measure, he gradually shut off Franco-Burgundian commerce and likewise blocked Burgundian trade routes running through France and other lands. In this regard, Louis was indeed a modern monarch, thinking about total conflict and not just armed forces. And one of the things that Louis was brilliant at was always keeping his opponents off guard. He moved around. He was very much a traveler king. His opponents never were really sure where he was at any moment. And he was a genius at sowing dissension amongst his enemies and confusion. Now, one of my continuous frustrations with our own leaders, including governors, representatives, senators, and presidents, is their insatiable desire to get elected and stay in office. So few have a real reason to do so. In other words, it's just get into the office and stay there, and nothing else. I actually think it's worsening. Ronald Reagan was the last president, in my opinion, with a specific aim in mind, to accelerate America's greatness through conservative means. In other words, domestically, reduce state activity and personal lives, and internationally, rebuild American power. From the firing of the air traffic controllers, to his tax reforms, to restocking the nuclear arsenal and the Strategic Defense Initiative, to his talks with Gorbachev, Reagan knew where he wanted to go. He had a vision, and he pursued it, and he marshaled all the forces at hand to do so. And a quick aside, of the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, derided at the time in the 1980s as Star Wars? Well, that was what just saved Israel a few weeks ago from some 150 Iranian missiles. Guess who was one of those people who was deriding Star Wars at the time? Why, that would be Joe Biden, one of the skeptics in the 1980s. But recently, Biden took credit for the success, and to that, of course, he did. Barack Obama, more than H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton or W. Bush, had a specific domestic agenda, he sure did, the expansion of domestic government, but even that was reactionary. His real aim was more about his own personal legacy build. However, that played out more than any specific goal. His work after the bank crisis began before his presidency. The Affordable Care Act was unfinished business from the Clinton administration's original Hillary Care. And in foreign policy, his pursuit of a treaty with Iran and Secretary of State John Kerry was more about having anything, something to leave to his legacy regarding foreign policy than it was about truly curbing Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon. I would argue that Obama, even more than W. Bush's War on Terror, which was forced upon him by 9/11, set the tone for the foreign policy we have had for the last 16 years. When I think of Obama's foreign policy, I think of the John Krasinski-directed and Emily Blunt-starring movie The Quiet Place. The film's premise is that unbeatable aliens with very sharp hearing have landed on Earth. As long as the humans are quiet, as long as they are silent, the aliens will leave them alone. President Obama was caught in an open microphone telling Russian President Dmitry Medvedev he would have more flexibility to negotiate on missile defense after the November election. In other words, as long as America would be really quiet, they will not do anything. This was the premise behind Obama's ridiculous Iran treaty and his approach to North Korea. The past three presidents have been so concerned with the conflict on their watch that they're ignoring the actions of our adversaries, which has invited conflicts on their watch. Putin's invasion of Crimea in 2014, his invasion of Ukraine in 2022, North Korea's continued missile tests, China's expansion in the South China Sea, and especially Iran's use of proxies to directly attack U.S. servicemen are all a result of this "shh, don't make a sound" approach to foreign policy. What do Donald Trump or Joe Biden wish to accomplish apart from achieving the presidency itself and, in Trump's case, maybe giving himself a pardon? Trump likes the office as an extension of his insatiable 50-year quest for fame. Biden is the feather in the wind, blown around by the loudest, most vociferous voices in his party. An argument could be made that presidents entering office with specific agendas are bad things, and domestically, I tend to agree with that when I think about the versions of Wilson or FDR's New Deal. But that should not be the case with foreign policy, which unlike domestic spending, is almost certainly in the purview of the executive. Here are a few questions. What is the goal of our foreign policy beyond the vague term American interests? Who are our key allies? Who are our geopolitical opponents? And what is the approach to each of them? What are our plans, region by region? For example, our approach to India would differ from that of Europe. What is the role of NATO today? What is the role of NATO in 5 years? And what about the Pacific region? What is our policy there? As I write this, I'm on the State Department website, and the first policy I see is anti-corruption and transparency. We prioritize anti-corruption and seek to make it even harder for criminality and terrorism to take root and spread, to promote governments that are more stable and accountable, and to level the playing field for U.S. businesses to compete in every region. But what does that mean? The following two issues are both climate change on the website. Yes, the State Department is obsessed with climate change, and there is even a COVID piece in the top five. Only non-proliferation of arms lends itself to any concrete policy. The rest of it is gobbledygook, the kind of thing a campaign staffer would write rather than an expert in foreign affairs. The White House website is not much better. It does not even address international policy until the seventh item, and that is, President Biden will take steps to restore America's standing in the world, strengthening the U.S. national security workforce, rebuilding democratic alliances across the globe, championing America's values and human rights, and equipping the American middle class to succeed in a global economy. This is one of my favorite concepts. I call it the opposed to what argument. Put in opposed to what in any space here and you will see what I mean. For example, championing America's values and human rights, as opposed to not doing this? At least the middle class part is something, as opposed to what? Equipping wealthy and poor classes to succeed in a global economy? Good, say I with a snidely whiplash cackle. I do not want to see the poor succeed in a global economy. And how about this policy somewhere? We will repudiate the Iran treaty, which was Trump's policy, or support it, Biden's. That is a debate, not the pablum on tap on these sites. However, such specifics may arouse opposition. So instead, foreign policy is conducted with the goal of trying not to antagonize anyone. And God forbid, our allies strike back. We do not allow the Ukrainians to lob projectiles into Russia for fear of Putin's wrath, nor give the Israelis a free hand to do what we would do if we were Israel, unleash the CIA and Qatar, and take out the Hamas leaders. Biden is terrified of a greater Middle Eastern war, but that is already happening. And fear the Iranians? Does one would think that they would attack our forces directly instead of through proxies if they were not afraid of our reprisals? They do not do so because they know that we would take the full measure, unlike the limitations we impose on our allies. So to go all acronym on you, I would ask WWLD, what would Lewis do? Let's take Iran. Lewis would be in every capital from Amman, Jordan, to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, building a coalition to contain the Islamic Republic. He would figure out every economic way to put them out of business with a combination of sanctions and a ways to reduce the price of oil, which would hurt Russia, Venezuela as well, and be an incredible blow to their economy. He would be unequivocally supporting Israel, knowing that Arab Americans, even ones in battleground Michigan, have no choice but to vote for him. Louis would be building a strong resistance within the Iranian Republic as well. It is not even the tactics. Louis would have the vision, the energy, the discipline, and the resilience to see the job through. He would weave his web, and any who got entangled in it would wish they had sided with him all along. Thank you for listening to the latest of this Conservative Historian podcast. And again, please check out all of them. Thanks again for listening. This is A.D. Tippett.